The week was consumed by the state visit of President Higgins to the UK, declared by everybody, or almost everybody, at least, to have been a wonderful success. But it was business as usual at home, with the Public Accounts Committee continuing its investigations into rehab and the terms of reference set for the inquiry into the Garda tapes. There was the tragedy too, of course, with the death on Monday of 25-year-old Peaches Geldof. For a look back at the week's events, I'm joined in studio by Mick Clifford, columnist with the Irish Examiner, journalist and author Martina Devlin, UCD historian Professor Jeremy Ferriter, and Colette Brown, columnist with the Irish Independent. Good morning to you all. Thanks for coming in. It really was mostly, I won't say not all, about the state visit, Michael Clifford. What did you make of President Higgins' trip across the water?
Well, as could be expected from Michael D, to be fair to me, conducted himself very well. Delighted to see that he's a slight tendency to go off centre when he does speeches. He's a slight tendency to ramble into esoteric avenues, you might say, which he reined in fairness to him, all this week. From a political perspective, you know, you'd have to say that it's something of a postscript rather than the main event when you compare it to the Queen coming here 3 years ago. However, the one constituency I think it meant a huge amount to, a constituency that has been ignored by the establishment here gone back decades, and that is the Irish exiled in Britain, and particularly in that regard, those who travelled over there 20 years and more ago. And one of your texters there referred to those who weren't doing so well. And I lived over there for a while, lived in another place. Well, I've always suspected that sense of alienation for those who travelled to England in particular, for a certain number of people, it was always an extra burden that they didn't carry lightly. And I think for all those kind of people, this was something, it was a valediction of some sorts, the president going over there at this stage, I think, from that point of view. So for them, I think it was a huge event and very well regarded. And it was nice to see that for once there was a certain amount of coverage of their plight over there.
And Martina, there's no doubt about the validity of what that listener was saying when they said, look, it's not making a big impact on the media there. Although the BBC did lead with it, I think, on Tuesday evening after the state banquet and so forth. Interesting contrast, by the way, in page one, but this wouldn't be the first time, of the Daily Mail on Wednesday, they had a big splash of Martin McGuinness and a man protesting against him outside Windsor. That was the London edition. Here, when I got back, I saw that it was a wonderful, warm picture of the President and the Queen. But nonetheless, what did you make of it?
Well, as regards the Daily Mail, that's knowing your market, isn't it? I wouldn't have thought of it as a postscript at all to the visit 3 years ago. I thought it was very important from the point of view of the peace process, which has been sidelined. And that's natural enough up to a point, in the sense that the Republic has had a lot of other fish to fry over the past 6 or 7 years with the economic collapse. But you can't presume that the peace process is all done and dusted and everything will be grand. It's an ongoing process. You know, it's a work
hence
in progress.
Hence the importance, though, Martina, yes, of last night's event.
Exactly. And hence
this, that's the themed reception at Windsor Castle.
Yes, and the whole theme of the visit, if you like, was reconciliation, not recrimination. And that's a pretty good theme, particularly in light of, you know, a troubled history. Now, I think that it's been important that the President has made a point of saying, look, everything hasn't been roses for a good number of years, because colonisation is a brutal, brutal process and we were on the receiving end of it. There's no two ways about it. But look, we have to move towards the future. It has to be a shared future. And I think that's why the North is so important, because that shared future is hitting a few roadblocks. You know, everybody doesn't respect the other tradition there. I mean, there's growing respect for it, but you can see with the flags issue, you can see with the proliferation of peace walls, that there's more work to be done. And I think Queen Elizabeth really championed that this week. And I think it's an important act of leadership. And I hope that both David Cameron's government, and more particularly our government here, picks up the baton and runs with it. Really love to say, which is a real problem in the North, is the lack of integrated education. Young people grow up not knowing each other. The first time you meet someone from the other tradition is in the workplace. And by then, all the harm has been done.
Or even at a third level education.
Yes,
when you get
or
to
third
Queens
level
if you
education.
Go there,
but
yeah,
you're a grown up by then. You need children to grow up alongside each other and be educated together. And the Catholic Church, unfortunately, is of all the faiths, the one which is putting up roadblocks to this. All the other faiths in the North are open to integrated education, but the Catholic Church is not.
That's perhaps a subject we might explore further on another occasion. But Colette Brown, This morning, it's been a long week. The president is doing something of a discourse in Stratford-upon-Avon, appropriately enough, on the fact that we share a language in common, and he's analysing how the English language is used. But he says at the very start of that speech, the words exchanged between Ireland and England have often been part of a long and sometimes tortured exchange. We cannot pretend that it was always a happy and friendly affair. To do so would be a disservice to truth and history. So do you think he's more or less, and has the Queen as well, have they got the balance right?
I think they have, and the Queen made reference to not being, our futures not being enslaved or determined or ensnared, I think was the word she used, by our past anymore. So I think they struck the right balance. I take a slightly different view on the state visit, and I'd have some sympathy with the texter who said they thought the coverage was slightly OTT. I think it was important on a formal basis, but I think for the average guy in the street, we didn't really need to see the President hobnobbing with the Queen in order to feel that we'd somehow been reconciled with people in Britain. I don't think people felt
well,
that.
Well, you can hardly blank out those pictures, though, either. It was, after all, the first state visit to the United Kingdom by an Irish head of state.
Yeah, and it was important, I think, on an official level, but then just I don't think really that it was, you know, so important for people. I think the divergence in coverage maybe between the Irish media and the British media, I don't know whether it suggests whether we're more obsessed about our relationship with Britain than they are necessarily with their relationship with us, or whether it was just you know, a fluke of the kinds of stories that were featured more prominently in the British media this week.
Jim, as the professional historian who's going to look forward as well as back to 2016, before I bring you in, I want to just give a reminder through two brief extracts. First of all, some of what the Queen had to say about the upcoming centenary of the 1916 East
Pains and battles of the war. We will remember and honour their contribution and sacrifice, just as we remember our own. My family and my government will stand alongside you, Mr. President, and your ministers throughout the anniversaries of the war and of the events that led to the creation of the Irish Free State.
That was the Queen on Tuesday night at the state banquet at Windsor Castle. And here's an extract from the President's reply when he spoke about living in the shadow of each other.
As Shan Uckle, a wise saying, often applied to the mutuality of relationship, it observes simply, a scoa caola, a warmid. Because scoa literally means shadow, this phrase is sometimes translated as we live in the shadow of each other. However, there is a more open and more accommodating meaning. Skoal also means shelter. Because skoal, the word embodies the simple truth that physical proximity brings with it an inevitability of both mutual influence and interaction. But more importantly, I believe it implies the opportunity, even the obligation, of reciprocal hospitality and generosity.
So some of the moments there, the highlights from the state banquet at Windsor Castle, Dermot Ferriter, it looks like maybe even the Queen herself might be on the way back. No, she is 87, we have to remember, but it looks like a senior royal family member will be with us in 2016.
If you look at the content of those speeches, it underlines how important words are, how important the gestures are, how important the symbolism is. And the President obviously brought a degree of eloquence and intelligence to the task that he had. Referred on numerous occasions, obviously, to the shared history, the tortured history, the difficult history, but also what the two countries have in common. Undoubtedly historic, it's a milestone. You're looking at a Queen and a President of Ireland as co-equal sovereigns. That's very significant historically, given everything that has happened. The question now, of course, is where do you bring this? How appropriate is it to invite members of the royal family to Dublin in 2016. It does seem to me that they have left themselves wriggle room. It's unlikely to be the Queen, it's unlikely to be perhaps a senior royal figure. But even the very idea of a royal in Dublin in 2016, is that appropriate? Who should be consulted about it? Is this an issue for the state? Does the legacy of 1916 not belong to the people? Is this something that has been decided behind the scenes and now they're going to decide where exactly they're going to fit them in? Will that mean in 2016 that the big focus and the big story will be the royal presence in Dublin, as opposed to us trying to understand what 1916 was about and the motivations of those who were involved? There's a big difference between commemoration and history. commemoration is propelled by contemporary political priorities, by the peace process, by all that we've heard there. There's nothing wrong with that. It can be very, very positive, and this was a very positive visit. History is different. History is about trying to understand nuance and context and what motivated people and what evidence is there to make us realise what motivated people. And I would question the appropriateness and the wisdom of the focus being on the royal presence in Dublin in 2016. And don't forget, as one of your texters earlier on in the programme referred to, there are those who are also struggling, as they see it, with what this means for them and their status, those who feel that they are still
being
occupied.
Sounds, Jim, so, like you would be in favour, perhaps, of a minor royal coming on Easter Tuesday, but nobody outside the GPO on Easter Sunday.
Not necessarily a minor royal either. I wonder about whether we need any royals. You know, do we have to share everything now? You know, reconciliation is very, very important. But do we have to share everything? You know, what message do they want to send out in 2016 about what is being marked? And that's where you have to be mindful.
Is it not more important, Dermot, the nature? Surely the bigger debate is the nature of the commemoration that is going to come about. I mean, we've seen commemorations in the past being hijacked for contemporary political motives. And I think it's a far bigger question, the nature of commemoration, than whether or not somebody from the royal family...
But I just want to emphasise, I'm not making a political point here. I'm speaking as a historian.
Yes,
I don't want the history to be lost.
On that point, the Taoiseach did say that ministers will work with authentic historians before deciding what events might be appropriate for the royal family to attend.
I may be an authentic historian. I'm not sure what an authentic historian is. Perhaps I am one of them. I presume what the Taoiseach is referring to there is an expert advisory group that was appointed by the state 2 years ago, of which I am a member. And the idea is that we would advise the state on how they might approach certain of the official commemorations. And remember, there's a difference between official state commemorations and what people might choose to do outside of that. Now, the idea is that the government will make a decision, or that already has made a decision, that there will be a royal presence or they'll be invited. And then perhaps they're going to ask an advisory committee, where should they be placed?
Well, certainly the Queen seems to be accepting an invitation when she says, we will stand with you.
I can assure you that the advisory committee was not consulted on, you know, this decision in the first place. And this is one of the interesting things about advisory committees or groups, that they are asked to advise after the decision has been made, as opposed to actually advising on whether that decision should be made in the first place. And of course, the state would say that that's its business. But it'll be very interesting to see what would come back if advice was sought from a group of historians, because you can be guaranteed you're not going to get a consensus from historians about what is the appropriate thing
Sorry,
to do.
Sorry, dear, but will there be a Northern Unionist presence at the commemoration? Do you
Eamon
know?
Eamon Gilmore went to the
discussed?
British Irish Association last September. This is where this first came up. And a British journalist contacted me afterwards and couldn't understand why this was not a story in the Republic. This was in September of last year. And what Gilmore said at that time is that he wanted or hoped the unionist communities as well as representatives of the royal family.
I hadn't heard that at all, and I'm really pleased to hear it.
The British Irish Association, I mean, it perhaps does not get much media attention anymore, and a lot of the proceedings are behind closed doors. But this was a speech that was released to the media.
If a senior royal is present in 2016 at the GPO or whatever, I would love to see Ian Paisley there. I think that, you know, if that's
the
kind of
thing... It's also linked. If you look at the themes that the President explored in his speech at the Palace of Westminster in particular, he really strongly emphasised Daniel O'Connell, Stephen Gwynne, Tom Kettle, people we associate with the constitutional tradition. A lot of people would see that as a necessary corrective to a historic...
Did he mention
neglect.
John Redmond, by the way, by name?
No, not that I'm aware of. But the interesting thing about that is you have to then ask, you know, is the pendulum going to swing so far that there won't be any reference to what motivated Republicans in Ireland 100 years ago? So it's a very difficult balancing act, this. And there are those who will celebrate the idea of embracing, once again, constitutionalism. But let's not pretend that they were flawless and that they had all the answers.
OK, now to look at rehab. Yesterday morning, Colette Brown, they were back at the Public Accounts Committee without the two people, probably with most public attention on them, Angela Cairns, former chief executive, who resigned or retired recently, and her predecessor Frank Flannery. A lot of other information coming out about Mr. Flannery's fees amounting over 7 years to some €400,000. There seems to be a total standoff, though, between Frank Flannery particularly and the committee, and it now looks like they're will probably have to try to use powers of compellability to have him before them.
Yeah, and the problem with that is nobody's quite sure whether those powers actually exist because it's never actually been tested or tried before. And given the tone of the correspondence that the PAC received from both Angela Kearns and from Frank Flannery, it's highly dubious that they would just, acquiesce if they were to get this request. It would in all likelihood end up down in the courts and a protracted legal battle. I think Shane Ross yesterday said that it was like Hamlet without the prince. And I think there were a few ghosts, all right, flying around. The board got a bit stirring from all of the members, but it was a well-deserved monstering. And I was particularly bemused by Angela Curran's withdrawal. Like she said that she didn't want them to discuss either her pension entitlement or her salary, but she herself had been before the committee last month and had discussed her salary. So it was almost like she was asking the committee members to unknow details.
And she was also saying that she had incorrectly told them that she hadn't had any reduction in her income this year, that that was now an inoperative statement. But Martina, is there information that this committee can only get from Frank Flannery and Angela Cairns, or are they just trying to prove a point?
I think it's an exercise in accountability and transparency. And from that perspective, it's regrettable that Frank Flannery won't appear voluntarily. I mean, obviously it's a game of chicken. He's putting it up to the committee to compel him. We don't know if they can or not. But, you know, citizens are the losers by it. This lack of accountability, really, I think, is really damaging. And Frank Flannery is claiming there's a witch hunt against him. The suggestion appears to be that because there's a Fianna Fáil chairman, he won't get a fair hearing before the Public Accounts Committee. But I think any chairman would be obliged to have him in.
I suspect it's more subtle than that. It's because he's Fine Gael that Fine Gael have to be seen of to course. Hang him out to dry in the same way as Fianna Fáil had to hang Charlie Haughey out to dry in a previous time. And now later, Bertie.
Well, but for somebody who has paid over $400,000 since 2007 for professional fees consultancy and lobbying of politicians to then refuse to appear before a bunch of politicians and ask some very simple questions about his role in an organisation that he was highly involved with, I think is, you know.
What's funny about this is that PAC has now become shorthand for something else. I met someone
Frank Flannery might say show trials.
Well, he would say that too, but also he hasn't, well, he can't say that yet because he hasn't participated in a show
trial. Well, if he has a television, he could but make that.
You know, Frank Flannery want to have it both ways. I mean, he is not prepared. As far as he's concerned, they've already got their heads on a plate. He's not prepared to go in there, but he's prepared to talk to journalists. And he made this extraordinary assertion that we have got value for money. The money that was given for his services.
There's an overriding issue as well.
He's saying that to journalists, but he's not prepared to go in.
Well, he's saying, I think he's pointing out the fact that rehab had to compete for a state business to provide services. There were other agencies that could have provided the same services.
Why not point that out in the Public Accounts Committee?
There's an overriding issue as well, and that is, this is continuing to damage the brand of rehab in particular and the charity sector in general. Now, Miss Cairns and Frank Flannery both over the years often traded on the fact that they were working for a non-profit organisation in terms of their reputation, in terms of the work they were doing and the good work that does come out of rehab. And yet, having got excellent salaries and apparently extremely generous pensions, we see that they're not that they're willing to continue to see the name of rehab besmirched and dragged on in this process by not showing up. I mean, it's difficult to fathom the whole thing in that regard. They're putting what they regard, they're positioning themselves, suggesting that there's some kind of a witch hunt. And, well, to be fair, one thing I will say about the PSC, they certainly seem to be enjoying their role in that last week trying to get in on the Garda tapes thing, I think, was really stretching it a small bit. But having said that, they're perfectly entitled in this regard in terms of looking public money to ask the two of them to come in, and that the two of them will continue to see rehab's name dragged around like this speaks volumes more than
anything. Well, like, what sums it all up for me is a couple of years ago they were asking the ordinary staff in rehab to take pay cuts, and the reasons that they were giving
and
was
closing facilities as well.
Yeah, but they were linking their pay to pays generally in the civil service. So it was okay when they were asking the ordinary people to take pay cuts, it was okay for them to be linked to state salaries. But then when it was the, you know, the CEO and the top staff suddenly it was a commercial organisation and no details at all could be released about salaries.
The other thing is I'd love to see the details of what Frank Friendly got 400 grand for. Was it stopping somebody in the rabbit in the corridor, Leinster House? Any chance of having a look at that grand, tot that up, another invoice? I'd love to see the actual details of this consultancy.
Will it need lead to more clarity about what the PAC can and cannot do? Because that's an important question.
Yes, and it will probably hasten the day when the long-promised register of lobbyists may be published. I presume that's something you would regard as a good thing, Martina.
I think it's essential in all walks of life. I mean, newspaper columnists are lobbyists as well. You need to know all that.
OK, now moving on. The terms of reference, as we know, have been laid out by the government for the Garda Tapes inquiry. Before we talk about the work to be done by Mr Justice Niall Fennelly of the Supreme Court, let's recall what Alan Shatter had to say. He was speaking to Paul Reynolds and others on Wednesday night. I saw this clip on the 9 o'clock news just on arrival back from our days in Windsor and Westminster. Here's Alan Shatter talking about the resignation or retirement of the former Garda Commissioner Martin Callan.
I'm not going to make any comment on that issue. That's an issue that has been dealt with. Any questions arising in relation to it will be dealt with, I presume, and by the statutory Commission of Inquiry.
An issue, Michael Clifford, that has been dealt with. Did something happen while we were off in Westminster? Can you enlighten us?
I can, yeah. No, absolutely. Nothing happened and nothing is going to happen for a long time. I mean, the inclusion, to me there's three elements that included in these terms of reference. A, the Garda Tapes affair, which personally I think has been blown up to be bigger than it will ultimately turn out to be. B, the Ian Bailey affair. Now, I think it's very welcome, and I have to say I was surprised that what is included was effectively a complete investigation into the events surrounding that, even though I'm dubious as to whether it goes beyond the Gardaí and whether to look at the DPP and the Department of Justice, etc. But at least there is an investigation into whether things were done properly or not by the Gardaí. The third element, this thing of investigating the events from last November into March leading up to the discovery of this letter going to the department 10th of March, etc., leading up to the resignation of the commissioner, that to me is bordering on being an abuse of process. That is a political matter that should be dealt with in a political forum like the Justice Committee. It has no business whatsoever being in a commission of investigation. It's completely against the spirit, at the very least, of that act that was set up in 2004, and there's no question it is done entirely to long finger any embarrassment for any party along the way. Fianna Fáil, in their worst incarnation over the last 10 years, wouldn't have had the neck to even try that one.
I think the inclusion of the Duplantier case is very significant. That's a 17-year saga, and there have been those who have been asking questions about that for a long time. If you fit it into a broader context then about what this says about the nature of the Garda Síochána and how they might have been doing business over many decades. I mean, this month marks the 30th anniversary, for example, of the Kerry Baby saga, and that led to a tribunal, which was really about how the Gardaí had handled that investigation. And you also had in the 1990s all sorts of questions about what was going on in Donegal in relation to the Gardaí. And now we have this. The interesting thing is perhaps not just the light it might shed on how they were going about their business, but the extent to which there was an awareness beyond that. Like, what other institutions of the state are you talking about?
As well, dear Madonna, I mean, there's no question about their business, how they were let go about
the tribunal was 82 days. It may be that a commission will be a lot more effective and produce a report much quicker
than
the tribunal.
Whether that report will be acted on will once again be the main issue.
Yeah, but coming back to the resignation or the departure of the Garda Commissioner, Colette Brown, Pat Leahy, I think, put it rather well last Sunday in the Business Post, where he said, "We still don't know what was said to the Garda Commissioner, which put him in a position where he felt obliged to leave office." Do you think you know why Martin Callan left his position?
I think I've a fair idea.
Do you think that the government has explained to you?
No, but the government hasn't. But if you're just reading the signs, I suppose you don't send a senior Secretary General from a department around just to have, you know, a chat about inanities and, you know, a hobnob biscuit. I think it's pretty clear that, you know, he was like, he was told, you know, resign or
well,
else.
We all
might have our beliefs, but Martina Devlin, nobody has told us, even though Alan Shatter is saying that's been dealt with.
Martin Callanan told us, though. Sources close to Martin Callanan, and we all know that the sources close to Martin Callanan, we know what those sources were, and he made it clear that he was not given much of a choice.
The thing about the inquiry is that it's so broad and there's so many disparate factors in it. I'm not sure that it's going to take a year.
That's my problem with it.
But putting in the events surrounding his departure from office, the resignation, is that not a way of the government just ducking the questions?
Completely.
Yeah, so exactly, because if the report doesn't, if everything has to be investigated before the report ultimately concludes, it could be 3 or 4 years before finding out why, you know, Commissioner Callaghan stepped down or resigned or whatever word you want to use yourself. So I'd agree with Mick. I mean, there's an imperative that aspect, and I think the Justice Committee have made a request that aspect of the inquiry be done.
Yeah, they have. That's entirely redundant. They've requested a module and be done expeditiously, and I don't think that's going to happen. And they have bent over, and once more than anything, it once again shows the redundancy of the Oireachtas compared to the executive. Again, that you have what should be an Oireachtas committee asserting itself, and the government members in particular have bent over backwards and done what they're told by the executive.
There's also the point that, and I think this is made in a very lengthy piece in the Phoenix magazine today, that done 4 pages going back over it, that particularly in regard to the Bailey case, there's information which was available to government, available to ministers, available to Gardaí for many years, and which came right back front and centre in the proceedings in November, when they had to give certain documents and information to the Bailey lawyers. And the question then arises, you know, what if anything did the Gardaí, what if anything did Alan Chatters, Minister for Justice, do about that information when it was brought back to the forefront again, Martina?
Oh, I mean, I'm totally noddled by it all, to tell you the truth, Sean. And the real thing that I take from it all is that there's a leadership issue and a governance issue at the head of the Gardaí. And that's what really, really concerns me about it all. And yes, we can point to the Kerry babies and the Donegal division, and we can point to the Ian Bailey case. But I mean, it's just one thing after another, and all of it points to governance issues.
One quick element to it, Sean. The other issue is the French, the whole cooperation, the allowing French investigators to come over here and investigate something that happened on Irish soil. Do you think for one second, if there was a reciprocal arrangement with Britain or France, that they'd have allowed Gardaí Síochána to come over and investigate something there? And all of this being done and being acquiesced with by the government at a time when Mr. Bailey and his partner are bringing a civil action against the state, it is extremely dubious, and it's still going on even now, in that their investigators are due again next month.
Right, just to digress completely in a different direction, the Champions League semi-final draws, Real Madrid versus Bayern and Atletico Madrid versus Chelsea. And also, we did promise, and we should have given you these semi-final draw outcomes a lot earlier, and also in the Europa League semi-final, Sevilla versus Valencia, or Valencia as my sports colleagues call them, and Benfica versus Juventus. Now to the other story of the week, an absolute tragedy, the death of Peaches Geldof. Unclear still what actually happened, but news of her death, Colette, it did rock this country and the UK.
Yeah, because of her, obviously her father is Bob Geldof would be a, you know, very high profile figure here. I think a number of commentators during the week, I suppose, have, like, because she was so well known for her whole life, maybe not necessarily for doing, you know, that much. She was a columnist, she was a TV presenter, her roles seemed to vary, but she turned from kind of a hell-raising teenager into sort of an earth mother, domestic goddess type figure, having retired or moved down to the country, was raising 2 children, seemed to be living an idyllic, very happy life. And spoke in a column that she wrote quite recently about how, you know, becoming a parent was the happiest time in her life. So all of her all of her words now are imbued with an additional poignancy. I think the speculation around her death has been, you know, very unhelpful. Some of the media have
it's
acted pretty terribly.
Unexplained, but not suspicious.
You have to wonder, Sean, though, about the priorities of the way these things are reported. I mean, obviously, if you consider the news, who was killed as a result of that horrible accident with a Lewis and a car. And that was kind of relegated to a footnote on that night. And it does make you wonder about the priorities. Of course, it was a tragedy. And it raises all sorts of questions about inherited celebrity and what that does to younger people.
It's a reflection of her celebrity culture.
She was a child of celebrity navigating the celebrity world. And I mean, it's really sad, but it's no sadder than the death of any other young mum. And the problem is, I think,
but people would have identified with her.
Well, only because
they knew her.
Only because they, exactly, only because they think they know her. And that's because, you know, she posts photographs of herself with her sons. There's this kind of false intimacy. But in fact, you know, Joe Public and Joanne Public doesn't really want these people to be having wonderful lives. What's a nasty part of human nature is that you want to see people whose lives appear glitzier than yours come to the bad.
I think the only other element, to be fair, is Bob Geldof has experienced the amount of tragedy in terms of the average person, the mind celebrities, in terms of his wife soon after dying and now his daughter dying. I think anybody, and well, he has a lot of affection in public mind here.
Our condolences to him, and may his daughter Peaches rest in peace. Michael Clifford, Martina Devlin, Colette Brown and Jim McFerriter, thank you for joining us for our Friday gathering.